Now, we're talking about assigned stuff today, and I don't know that I'd necessarily want to preach this in a gospel meeting. I don't know that I'd necessarily want to preach this anywhere, because I got four daughters, and my wife's also a girl. Okay, and as we, for a while, we had a female cat, and he lived for 13 years until there was a boy that came by the name of Evan, now married to one of my daughters, but the first time he ever visited our house, he ran over the family cat with a car, not once, but twice. All right, because she had pulled up under his car, and he backed out, and he thought he heard something. He pulled forward, and he got her coming and going. So I've been around a lot of girls, and I also know that talking about this can be very controversial, but nonetheless, it is a biblical topic, not necessarily always easy to understand, but we want to talk about that tonight. So as we talk about the topic of modesty tonight, by the way, let me thank you for the time that we've been able to spend together today. Appreciate that very much, and I hope that we get to see each other again sometime. Waverly is a good congregation. I can't remember your name right now, but the relative of B.B. James sitting right back there, I'm looking at her. We were talking about some good stories about Brother B.B. James because he loved Brother Thornton so much, and that's my wife's daddy. So Brother B.B. James and Brother J.A. Thornton were pretty close friends and know a lot of very positive things about him and other preachers in the area. So now let's go ahead and say now about modesty. Here we go. Now, I can't see that unless I step down some. Here's the actual passage itself that's under consideration tonight. Are we on the radio tonight? Are we? Okay, well, wonderful. We are on the radio tonight. Okay, so 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 8 through 10. I desire then that in every place the men should pray, lifting holy hands without anger or quarreling. Likewise also that women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel, with modesty and self-control, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly attire, but with what is proper for women who profess godliness with good works. Notice here there's a point-counterpoint sort of thing with Paul here. With regard to the work of the church there, he is saying to them a couple of things. First of all, here's the way that men should do this. Now, by the way, lifting holy hands is a symbol for prayer. All right, and so I want men to be able to pray in every place. And then, in contrast to that, I want women to adorn themselves in modest apparel. We often focus on verses 9 and 10, and we forget about verse 8, but that's the reason why Paul put it there to start with, and so we should focus on it. So as we're looking at that tonight, I've got some problems. The problems that I got is that sinful? You know, is that sinful for a woman to wear braided hair? Matter of fact, we have several daughters who can braid hair, but one in particular is really good at it. And she sometimes braids the hair of her sisters. And we've been to the Bahamas several times before. And what woman ever goes to the Bahamas for the very first time and doesn't come back with braided hair if she's got enough to braid? Okay, because they come back, and so is it wrong then to wear braided hair to church? And what about gold? I don't know who Shira is, and I don't really care that much. But I got the picture off the internet, and she's wearing a lot of gold. Some of you wearing some gold tonight. Matter of fact, I got on a gold thing here. Several of you are wearing gold tonight. So if it means then that it's always wrong to wear gold, especially like to church, what about pearls? Here are some women in various circumstances wearing pearls. Some of you probably wearing pearls tonight. So if you're wearing pearls tonight, is that wrong? Is it wrong, therefore, to always wear gold or braided hair or pearls? Or I didn't even ask you what you paid for your clothes tonight. You know, some of you, now, I have a French tailor, and his name is J.C. Penney. Okay, and so I wear some stuff from Penney's, and I wear some stuff from Sears, and I wear some stuff here and there. I've been known that coat I wore this morning cost $45 at a Hager outlet store that I got someplace in Florida. So I wear expensive clothes because I'm too stinking cheap. But a lot of people can wear some real expensive clothes. Now, what's the limit of wearing expensive clothes to church? Now, we can see here that there's a problem, isn't it? And the problem is that the passage is in an obviously changed cultural setting. The passage is in that changed cultural setting. And if you're going to say that the last part of it is binding and just ignore the first part of it, then there's a lot of people, especially young people, who think you're being disingenuous. They think that you're being a little hypocritical here because you do wear your costly garments. Some of you spend a lot of time with the clothes that you wear. And you do wear gold. And you do wear pearls. And you do wear braided hair sometimes. And so when young people see that, I've taught at Fried Hartman now for quite a while, they understand that it appears that we're being selective here with what we want to keep and what we don't want to keep. So it seems like we want to really stomp on the part about women dressing in modest apparel. Well, what are you going to do with that other stuff? So here is something that we've been talking about. And remember, the elders asked that I talk about this because I would not volunteer to do this any more than I would volunteer to have a root canal. Okay, but nonetheless, it is true that how does one separate the principle from the changed cultural setting? In other words, if you wear pearls tonight, well, who cares? If your hair is braided tonight, who cares? I didn't ask you how much jewelry you have on, and I happen to know that that Terry, you know, and my wife Joyce like bling. Well, are they in the church? I think they are in the church. Is it wrong, therefore, for somebody to be wearing that kind of stuff? Obviously, the cultural setting has changed. When you read something like salute one another with a holy kiss, how do you do that? Well, I preached in Peru before, and thankfully, just the women there, it's okay for Christian men to greet Christian women with a kiss off the right cheek. It's not really sometimes you might touch their cheek, but really it's not as much as maybe you would kiss your daughter or something like that on her cheek. But it's kind of like a kiss off the cheek, and you do that, and I'm fine. Then I went to preach in Argentina, and guess what? The men do it too. I mean, the men kiss like that. And so even these strong gaucho men in Argentina will greet one another in church that way. Let me tell you, that does not translate well in Henderson, Tennessee. If you come and you visit us, it's not something that men do with men here, but strong men in Argentina, I'm telling you, do that. When I left, the two elders, actually, the elders, well, there was three at that time, the elders at the church at that time, Villa Urquiza Iglesia de Cristo, whenever I left there, the elders did kiss me. Very similar to Acts chapter 20, where the elders fell on Paul's neck and they kissed him. Now, that's what your Bible says. But if that's true then, has anything changed? Well, yes. You don't do that in Middle Tennessee. You're liable to get hit if you try to do that in Middle Tennessee. All right, so what has changed here? It's a cultural difference. And in the same way, you should know when it's okay and when it's not okay to come up to a woman and kiss her on your right cheek. Usually, if she's approaching you and she wants to honor you, she may even lean her cheek towards you in order to kiss her on her right cheek. But that salute one another with a holy kiss, the churches of Christ salute you in Romans 16:16, certainly is in a cultural setting. So how do you separate the principle from the custom or the environmental, the actual environment of the text itself? Now, we have some people who say, well, every passage in the Bible that's in a cultural text, in a cultural setting, is therefore not applicable today to us if the cultural setting has changed. And therefore, there are some people out there who are trying to say, well, women, for instance, may take leading roles in worship because all of those passages are in a cultural setting. And since they all have changed, the principle has changed as well. Now, wait a minute. If you're going to say that, all of the Bible's in a cultural context, and none of us live under Middle Eastern cultures like they would have existed in the Bible times. So if you say that it's no longer binding on us just because it was in a cultural setting, you're wiping out the Bible. And when you do that, God is not happy because He has sometimes told us what He wants us to do by using cultural illustrations. Like, for instance, using cultural illustrations about B.B. James. A lot of people in the world might not know about Brother B.B. James, but he's part of the culture of Middle Tennessee and this area. And so I can talk about him, and you know who I'm talking about. If I talk about Paul Rogers at Centerville, you know who I'm talking about. If I talk about Lee Brown, who was here for a long time, then you know who I'm talking about. But that same cultural setting, I would not use those illustrations in some parts of the world because they cannot relate to them. However, if the roles of men and women are tied to creation, as they are in 1 Corinthians 11, 7 through 12, 1 Timothy 2, 8 through 15, and maybe even 1 Corinthians 14 and 34, that a woman should remain silent in the church, as the law also says, although we may not know exactly what the law is, Paul seems to be pointing to an abiding principle. I mean, a permanent principle that's not supposed to be changed. So when we talk about that, how does one separate principle from custom? We all got to do it. Because the Bible is in a cultural setting, and therefore what do we do? So let's first take a look at 1 Timothy chapter 2 a little closer. Cosmias. You might have heard the word cosmos before. Carl Sagan used to have a series called Cosmos, and it's the Greek word for world. So here's the way the Greeks thought about this. The world is very cause and effect related. You know, there's a cause and an effect. Everything in the world has an antecedent cause. So here's something in the world. There must have been something that caused it. When everything is working in that orderly manner, it's cosmos in Greek, which means it's orderly, it's appropriate, it's exactly the way that I would understand it, because if you understand what this cause is capable of, and then you look at the effect, you can say, wow, yeah, that's appropriate. That's in place. In other words, that's what the word means. Orderly, well-arranged, decent. And from that, we get the idea of modest. Why? Well, because if a woman has a heart that is right, then that heart will cause her to want to dress the way that she should dress. You see, there's the appropriateness there. The inside and the outside. It's appropriate, the inside and the outside. Another word is eidos, and it's the word of a sense of shame or modesty, self-control. A related word is used in Romans 1, verse 16, when Paul said he's not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, indicating that he's not red-faced. In other words, having the ability to blush, which it does seem that in the 21st century, it seems that that is a diminishing art. To have people who are modest enough, whether male or female, that they can blush, because as my wife would say, why in the world did your mother let you dress that way? You know, we were talking about this beforehand. I said, you know what I'm preaching about tonight? And I said, what would you say? And she said, I would want to say to some mothers, why in the world did you let your daughter or maybe your son leave the house that way? If they're in your house, then do you not have any control over the situation at all? In other words, are we teaching a sense of shame or modesty or self-control? Sobriety, King James would say, Vine's Expository Dictionary, soundness of mind, soberness, and sound judgment. Going to use another, a little bit more academic source here. The standard Greek lexicon would be BDAG, and it's Bauer, Danker, Arndt, and Gingrich. It is the standard that has been a standard for many years as far as definition of Greek words is concerned. And according to BDAG, the word cosmeo, which is related to the word that we were just talking about, cosmeos, means to set in order so as to appear neat or well-organized, to make neat or tidy, to cause something to have an attractive appearance through decoration, adornment, or to decorate. With proper clothing, in the passage is that word here. Now, you got katastole, and then that word that you've seen a derivation of, cosmeo. Okay, what does it mean? The phrase literally means in clothing that is becoming. Particularly with regard to our station as a Christian, it denotes being orderly. In other words, Jesus would say it this way. If you're going to find a person who's a Christian, you're going to find sweet things coming out of their mouth. Why? Because that person's heart is given to the Lord, and so good water will come from a good source. But if the source is bad, you ought to expect all kinds of bad stuff coming out of the mouth. Why? Well, because the person's going to curse, and the person's going to say bad things about others. The person's going to gossip. The person's going to do all kinds of things. Why? The source is bad. But if the source is good, then out of the mouth will come forth the water that you can drink. And he was using that as an illustration of, okay, it's one thing to try to change a student's behavior. My wife just retired a year ago. Can you see the smile on her face? Or she taught the second grade for several years, in the Jackson Mascanus school system, and so now she's not doing that. But one thing that you that you think about is that you literally want to consider what does it mean to act in a becoming way. So what she's trying to teach those second graders is there are some expectations that people will have of you, and you need to act in the right way if you expect good things to happen to you. Now, if you don't care what happens to you, talk any way that you want to, dress any way that you want to, wear your pants, you know, all the way down to you know where, and just do whatever you want to if you don't care. But if you do care, then you might want to consider making your behavior appropriate of those who would be in circumstances to make decisions about your future. In other words, you're going to get hired or not. If you're going to get hired, then exactly you know, what will happen in your life. The adjective that describes clothing here is used with reference to the behavior of an elder in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2. In other words, his behavior should be appropriate for the office that he holds. I just heard this last week about an eldership where a couple of the elders, apparently their behavior is not appropriate for elders. And that is a difficult problem for any congregation, because what do you do with elders when their behavior is out of line? So, it's important for all of us. Now, the word modestly, it involves a sense of shame, a sense of shame that is not merely external, but is rooted deep within the character. A moral abhorrence of doing anything disgraceful and inner reserve. It involves proper behavior, and in this case, proper clothing, that is held fast or firm by a sense of shame. So, when Rebekah found out that the servant of Isaac was looking for a wife for him, she put on her veil and the rest of her clothes because she wanted to appear as though she would be the sort of woman that would be appropriate to choose for a person like Isaac. And that's in Genesis chapter 24, verses 64 and 65. Now, another word that's related in the passage is sophrosune, and it means soundness of mind, reasonableness, rationality, the practice of prudence, good judgment, moderation, self-control, as exercise of care and intelligence appropriate to the circumstances. Now, we could go ahead and give you some more definitions, but I think you've got the idea now. In other words, the inside is going to reflect what's on the outside. And if it is what it is, then you respect that person for being authentic or for being the real deal. You know some people in your life who are Christians who are the real deal. And you probably also know some people in your life who come to church and on Monday or Tuesday you could barely recognize that they're Christians. So what you're supposed to do is if you could have your inside turned out, it'd be the same thing on the inside as there is on the outside, or vice versa. I remember one time when Joyce and I were just married, we went to an auction sale in Franklin, Tennessee, because this was BK, before kids. And so I saw a beautiful rectangular piano, and I thought, wow, that's a beautiful looking piano. And I was wondering why I was able to buy it for $85. Well, I did buy it for $85. It weighed roughly 1 million pounds. Okay, and I bought that thing, and I found out, lo and behold, that beautiful walnut of the piano was just a veneer. And when you look on the inside, it was that cheaper wood. And that's why smart people in the auction sale had not bought it, because they knew it was covered on the outside with something that was not what was on the inside. Now, it is the goal of every Christian woman and man, to be the same on the outside that they are on the inside, and to make sure that we clean up our insides. So, the point of 1 Timothy 2 is that a woman should watch her attitude. So, sometimes it's not what is worn, but the attitude with which it is worn. Or the way that a woman would carry herself with otherwise clothing that might be somewhat modest. Or it could be the behavior, and it could be the dress itself. In other words, articles of clothing might not be modest in and of themselves, and it might be the attitude of the woman who wears it, or the man who wears it. Therefore, it needs to be proper, which means fitting, seemly, suitable, becoming, for women making a claim to godliness. Women who seek to follow God's counsel in their behavior, according to 1 Timothy 2:9, and their attitude and their dress, will do so wherever they go and whatever circumstance they are in, whether it's inside or outside the assembly. Now, there are some things, obviously, that are wrong all the time. And one thing would be, in other words, we live in a society that's focused on sex. Whenever you're wearing articles of clothing that are focused on sex, whether or not you're in church or out of church, according to 2 Corinthians chapter 12 and Galatians 5, 16 through 21, in Romans 13:13, that's part of the partying scene. You know, that's part of getting drunk and going naked and getting wasted and, you know, living for the weekend so that you can do that and try to sober up on Monday morning so you can go back to work. There are so many people that seem to live that way. If you doubt that, look around at the places on Friday night and Saturday night where there are bars and see how many people are there. Now that is the kind of living that is always wrong, regardless of your dress. Now some of our brethren have tried to use the Old Testament, and I think that their motives are good. Their motives are good to try to use the Old Testament, try to set standards of modesty from the Old Testament. I'm going to give you three such passages tonight, and then I want you to reflect on them with me. All right, so can you use the Old Testament to determine any absolute standards of modesty? Now, by the way, there are some absolute principles of modesty, but I mean something that's immodest all the time, everywhere, in every culture, in every setting, etc., etc. Here are three that have been used, and I want you to consider them with me. Isaiah 47, 1 through 4. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate. Take the millstones and grind flour. Put off your veil, strip off your robe. Uncover your legs, pass through the rivers. Your nakedness shall be uncovered, and your disgrace shall be seen. I will take vengeance, and I will spare no one. Our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is His name, is the Holy One of Israel. And therefore, this is talking about the humiliation of Babylon in Isaiah 47, 1 through 4. It carries the idea of undressing to wade through water, among the other ideas. And that's one idea of the way that Israel would show, or Babylon would show her lack of shame. Now, okay, how far do you want to take this passage? All right, I think it's sometimes taken too badly too far. And one reason is, if you're saying, as some brethren say, well, a woman should never show her legs. Which part of her legs? The ankles? That's part of your leg, I think. Below the knee? The upper part of the knee. Now, is he talking about women who might be, who might have been unchaste enough to lift their skirts too high in order to go through water that's 12 inches deep? Now, I think you could very well be talking about that, but I want to ask you this question. Is one immodest if he or she does not wear a veil? Notice that also in the passage, not only does she lift her skirt high, but she takes her veil off. If you're going to bind that passage about the showing your legs, what part of the legs are you talking about? And secondly, why didn't you say anything about the veil? Because she's supposed to take off the veil and throw off her outer garment and then lift her skirt so that you could see her legs. If that's the case, then do we have an absolute principle here for all of Israel all the time? And would it be wrong for a woman to lift the bottom part of her garments at all to wade through water? So I'm thinking you're on real sticky exegetical territory if you use this to say that a woman is immodest if she shows any part of her legs. Because even if you're going to wear dresses to your knees, you are showing your legs. In Tanzania one time, I told the girls, I said, you know, here's the way they feel about it. Now, when women go to church, they wear skirts. They don't wear pants. If you wear pants on your day off, if you wear modest shorts on your day off, you may do so. But when you go to church, you wear shorts. So they all had on, you wear skirts or dresses. So they all had on skirts or dresses, and one of them, her dress was down to just the lower part of her knee until she sat down. Then when she sat down, you could see her whole knee. And some of the women in Tanzania at the church there went nuts. I mean, they said, wow, you can see her knees. That's terrible. That's awful. Now, this is the same culture where sometimes when you baptize them, they'll take off their outer wrapper to be baptized and fully expose their breasts. But they thought it was shameful to see the knees. So I said to my campaigners, I said to the girls especially, I don't care if you have to sew together pieces of clothes. I don't care what it is that you do. We're not going to have any more knees in church. You know, no more knees in church. Why? Because it really upset the ladies. And by the way, they have no problems whatsoever with openly breastfeeding. I can guarantee you that, because if you've never been to a culture like that and you start preaching and then you see that in the audience, it's going to be somewhat distracting. But they have no problems at all with that, but they didn't want to see our campaigners' knees. Now, were our girls immodest? They were not. Did it cause problems in that congregation in Arusha, Tanzania? It did. So what did we do? We corrected the situation. No more needs. All right, so this passage is, I think, here's the second one. For Aaron's sons, you shall make coats and sashes and caps. You shall make them for glory and honor, and you shall put them on Aaron, your brother, this is to Moses, and on his sons with him, and shall anoint them and ordain them and consecrate them that they may serve as priests. You shall make for them linen undergarments to cover their naked flesh. They shall reach from the hips to the thighs. All right, now this has also been used by some of our brethren today to say, well, see the principle there is you've got to be completely covered in order to be, you know, to be modest. All right, here's my answer to that. If this passage gives absolute standards for morality, then must we all wear caps? Why don't you have a cap on right now? To be modest, men, according to this passage, to be modest and to cover your naked flesh, some of you, I'm tired of looking at your bald spots. Because I got one here and I don't like, the only reason I'm okay with it is because I can't see my bald spot most of the time. All right, and so why don't you cover up your bald spots and put on caps? Because the sons of Aaron did, because they were supposed to be covered, because their flesh was naked. Now, here's another question. Why would anyone use this passage to determine how Christian women should dress today unless they didn't already have a predetermined agenda? In other words, if you already thought what you knew immodest was all the time in the United States, then you might, for instance, take that passage out of context. But if you went to that passage with an open mind, would you see any way there that you get an idea of how Christian women should dress today? By the way, did anyone in Israel ever go swimming? And if they did go swimming, did they go swimming in public? And if they did swim, did they wear all those garments all the time? In which case, that's what caused a lot of them to die. Because you can't swim, you know, with covered with all of that stuff and the veil and all that business. Brethren, the Bible doesn't say. The Bible doesn't say that it's wrong to swim. The Bible doesn't say exactly how they dress when they swim. And I kind of resent it when people are using Old Testament passages like this, when really what is going on there is not as clear as they make it to be. And the third one is, then the eyes of both were open, and they knew that they were naked, this Adam and Eve, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loincloths. And he said, I heard the sound of you in the garden, and I was afraid, because I was naked, and I hid myself. And the Lord God made for Adam, these are three different verses, 7, 10, and 21. And the Lord God made for Adam and for his wife garments of skins and clothed them. Now here's a Hebrew word for you if you want to know. It's from katef, which it means in Hebrew to clothe. All right, so first of all, are Adam and Eve married? Yes. Are they in a public setting? There is no public. They are the only ones. So how do you know from what's going on here that it would be wrong, for instance, in a public setting? Because there is no public setting. Secondly, if this is an absolute principle, why wasn't their nakedness wrong before the fall? Now remember, absolute principles don't ever change, right? They never change with any dispensation of time. They never change in the patriarchal age, the Mosaical age, or the Christian age. They never change yesterday, today, or tomorrow because they're absolute. Were Adam and Eve naked before the fall? Yes. Were they ashamed before the fall? No. Well, then what was it that changed? They ate of the fruit of the knowledge of the tree of good and evil, the fruit from that tree, and therefore, we don't know why did God allow them to be naked if it was intrinsically wrong when he made them? Why didn't he make them with clothes? And then finally, must all clothing be worn all the time? Now, we're dealing in the world here of values and ethics. And it's a big world. For instance, I'm glad I don't live in that desert. And even as humid as it is here, I'm still glad that I don't live here in Egypt. Because we've been there before, and I like to visit, and I like to leave. Most of our people were sick when they left. Because it's not a really clean place to be. In Cairo, it's a very nasty, dirty city. But nonetheless, it was good to go through the pyramids and to enjoy all of that kind of stuff. And yet in this world that we have out there, there's all kinds of values. Men, they eat stuff in various parts of the world that we don't eat here because it's unclean. What do we eat? Chitlins. Okay, you know, what do we eat? Catfish. You know what difference is in a catfish and a lawyer? One is a scum-sucking, bottom-dwelling scavenger, and the other one's a fish. Okay, so when you think of a catfish, if he's not farm-fed, think of the stuff that he eats in the Tennessee River. And for that matter, chicken livers. Let me just tell you, if you like chicken livers, I will pray for you. Why do people eat that part of the chicken? You know, and yet we can do that in this culture, and it's completely fine. Well, people eat some weird things in other cultures as well. So when we think about this, there's a big world out there of values and ethics. A value is something that somebody would consider to be important, but may or may not be right or wrong. It's just a value. But now, if we're talking about right or wrong, now that's an ethic. If we're talking about right or wrong, now that is an ethic. Is there any such thing as immodesty? Yes, there is. But I would like for us to avoid two extremes. Extreme number one, Christian men and women cannot show anything from neck to ankles. I mean, nothing. You know, you've got to be covered up all the time in church and all that stuff. I even had this discussion tonight about whether or not I had to wear a coat. I didn't ask the elders, but I asked some guys in the sound booth over here, Evan, and Evan said, it's all right with me if you don't wear a coat. Of course, I don't have anything to do with it. Okay, and so I decided not to wear a coat tonight because I didn't want to, and the elders are not dressed that way except for Billy, and he doesn't have a tie, so that doesn't count. You know, and so why is it that I have to wear a coat? Is it a matter of modesty? No. I think women probably invented ties anyway because they're going to kill off all the men. If you doubt that, look at the caskets. They're all wearing a tie, and they all died. So I'm kind of thinking now, why then is that important? Well, it's really not. Now, is dressing appropriately important? Yes. I would not want to dress in such a way that would be distracting from the message. Extreme number one. Extreme number two. All standards of modesty are relative and culturally determined, and therefore there's nothing specific that you can say about it. Well, I don't believe that. Christian modesty is an absolute principle that is reflected in varied cultures and cultural settings. For instance, the veil. I don't believe that Christian women should be wearing a veil tonight, unless, of course, you consider it a matter of individual conscience, and that's okay. But I don't think you should bind that on other women. Because I've preached in veiled churches before where the women wore veils, and I'm thinking of one congregation now where I said to them, I don't mind preaching here, and we'll even come and do and we did, a vacation Bible school, and we did a campaign of this congregation out west, and they were a veiled church, and I said, I don't mind this, but I don't want your women trying to tell our girls and our women that they had to wear veils in order to be spiritual. Well, the first night, there was like a 4 or 5 hour discussion in one of the houses with some of our girls and a woman there who wore the veil all the time. And so I called the men of the congregation together. I said, I told you I didn't want any problem out of the veil here because our women are not going to be wearing veils. And besides that, yours are not wearing veils either in the way the Bible talks about it. Because the two words for veil in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 means to wrap around and to hang in front. To wrap around, it's got to be big enough to wrap around your head. It's got to be big enough to hang in front, because that's the words that are used for veils. But when you think of Christian women today who think they're wearing the veil, they're wearing something about the size of a doily, and they put it on top of their head, you know, kind of, you know, like this or something, okay, and think that that's a veil. Brethren, that ain't a veil. Not in the Bible sense, that's not a veil. That's a doily. You know, if you're gonna bind the veil, then bind the veil. If you think you should wear one to church, then you may. But what you don't have the right to do is to tell everybody else that they can as well. But the principle behind it is binding. That is, that Christian women are to be in submission to males who, you know, preach and are elders, etc., etc. And that is something that is binding, but it's used in a setting that no longer is appropriate. For instance, even at a wedding today, if you went to a wedding, I've been to 2 weddings here in this building before, and I told you this morning who they were. If you went to a wedding and the girl didn't have a veil, does that mean that she's not a good woman? If she's not wearing a veil, does that mean she's not going to be in submission to her husband? Does that mean she's decided she's going to be rebellious? No. Why? Because the veil doesn't mean anything in our society. It doesn't mean anything. But what if it were known that she's decided, I am never going to be in subjection to my husband, then she would be in a sinful situation. So when we think about that then, I want you to think about it this way. I've got this on Pinterest. I want you to know that I knew what Pinterest was. Let me just tell you that I felt a little wormy being on Pinterest because men have no business being there. Okay, but Pinterest is the thing that a lot of women go to with various things, and I found this on Christian Modesty this afternoon at Pinterest. And so here's some advice from Pinterest, which I think is generally some pretty good advice for modest clothing. 4 guidelines for modesty. If you have trouble getting into it or out of it, it may not be modest. If you have to spray it on, it may not be modest. If you have to, you know, take a running leap in order to get into it, it may not be modest. Number 2, if you have to be careful when you sit down or bend over, it may not be modest. And I think the elders have in mind here the fact of perfectly good people that they believe have good attitudes, but sometimes the skirts might get a little short, the dresses may be a little short, and it's difficult when you're sitting down to cover everything that needs to be covered. In which case, that is a legitimate concern. And of course, obviously, people in charge of the assembly, like the elders, have the right to be concerned about this, because I can't prove this, I never have been a woman, but men are definitely visually oriented. And when men are visually oriented, now a woman might say, well, you ought to control yourself. Well, I sometimes have tried to do that in my life. Okay, I've tried to do this self-control thing, but sometimes it's also good to have the cooperation of the women folk. It's good to have that sort of cooperation. Nobody can tell you Bathsheba was sinning when David saw her, but she was bathing on the rooftop, and he saw her from a distance. I'm pretty sure she knew where he lived, the king of Israel. Why was she doing that? I do not know, and nobody could ever prove this. But I would like to think that she didn't do that in such a way so as to get her husband killed. I would like to think that that was not her motive. Hopefully, it was carelessness, and certainly on David's part, it was lust and sin. It led to a lot of negative things in Israel. Number 3, if people look at any part of your body before looking at your face, it may not be modest. In other words, why are you drawing attention to that? Now, this is difficult to express in a public way, but it is okay to dress attractively. And many of us are where we are now because our wives dressed attractively, because some of us are pretty dull of thinking, and if somebody doesn't hit us over the head with a 2x4, we have a difficult time, you know, trying to figure out what's going on in the world. So there's nothing wrong with dressing attractively, but you should not dress in a way so as to elicit lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the vainglory of life. 1 John 2:15 through 17. In which point, motives would be wrong. And then finally, if you can see your most private parts or an outline of those parts under the fabric, it's probably not modest. So sometimes it has to do with who, sometimes it has to do with what. By the way, these Christian principles apply to Christian men as well. Because Christian men sometimes dress in a way that draws attention to the wrong parts of their bodies, and they know that it does. And they do that because even though men are definitely visually oriented, I'm not saying that women are not, because women are visually oriented somewhat. I don't know whether or not it is to the same extent, but I have been a man most of my life, and I'm just going to tell you that we are definitely visually oriented. So when you think about the things that bother us, what we're saying here is, think carefully about choices that you make when you come to worship God. Think carefully about what you're going to wear and how you present yourself when you come to worship God. All right, so what we're saying then is that Christian modesty should be taken seriously by those who are in charge of church settings and recreational gatherings. For instance, church setting would obviously be the elders. Recreational gathering would be those in charge of a boating trip to the Buffalo, or a canoeing trip to the Buffalo, or something like that. Let your kids know what you expect of them. We will accept shorts down to here. We will not accept, you know, Daisy Mays, or we will not accept, you know, the swim trunks up to here, or whatever else. Just tell them what you want and be specific about it, rather than bemoaning the fact that they didn't dress the way you wanted them to dress and you didn't tell them any better. So tell them what you believe is acceptable. Often in this area of modesty, there is an absolute, of course, that the outside should be consistent with what's on the inside, and on the inside should be the commitment of Jesus. But it's also quite true that we have to help one another here and let our expectations be known. So, be careful about this. And let me say one more thing. We've got four daughters. And why? We don't want five. Okay, all right, we got these four daughters, and they're wonderful. We've got four grandchildren, and we want more of those. Modesty is something that's difficult because if you get down, I've been guilty of this. If you come down too heavy on your daughters, you can really damage them in some ways that would last a long time. Because it leaves images of the fact that my daddy thinks that I am an impure person. You could use other words for that. My daddy thinks that I'm not a good person because of the way that I dress. With our oldest child, I thought it was okay to spank my children in public because that was in the 70s and everybody was spanking their kids in public. We even had a time right after church that everybody just got together and spanked their kids. You know, and so that was okay to do that then. But I've also noticed that there are ways to correct your children that don't involve public humiliation. If there's somebody in church who needs to be reminded of maybe the fact that their clothing needs some attention, I think it would probably come best from a woman who is in a position of trying to make some suggestions that might come from the elders, rather than calling that lady in to an elders meeting, and then there's almost nothing good that can happen at that point. So if you really want to do something about this, set expectations and do this with meekness and with fear. Because girls are wonderful. They would give their lives for you. But it's also true that in some senses they are emotionally fragile. Not inferior. I got smart girls. They're not inferior to boys. But it is easy to hurt their sense of who they think they are. So if something like this needs to be done, please do so with reverence and fear, with discretion, as much as possible privately, and make sure that you're justified in doing this sort of thing, because it could be that if you do this wrong, you're doing something that is kind of irreversible in that individual case. We love each other. And sometimes there are girls that dress the way that they do because they really don't know how this comes across to others. So we need to examine our own motives and make sure that they are pure and chaste. And we need to be careful the way that we do it, because remember, girls are wonderful. But we want to treat them the way that we would want to be treated. Plus, many of these principles that I've been talking about apply to men as well. You see, here's the beauty of this. Live on the outside in such a way that people would not be misled about who you are on the inside. If you dress in a certain way that looks kind of hookerish, then it would lead some people to think that somehow or another, maybe that's the way that you are. And that's not really what you were going for. You want to be stylish. You want to fit in at school. You don't want others to laugh at you. All of that stuff I understand. But still, the abiding principle that is most important is that you look to see if what's on the outside is reflective of Jesus who is on the inside. Now, through faith, repentance, confession, and baptism, you can become a Christian tonight. Christian modesty is important for all of us and will be as long as we live in a public setting in the church. But let's bring Jesus the best that we can and not draw attention off of Jesus by the way that we wear that may not at times be appropriate while we stand and sing.
Yeah. In the world.